I'm Melanie O'Brien, the director of ArtSpeak, and I'm very pleased to introduce A.A. Bronson, who curated this terrific exhibition, Learn to Read Art, A History of Printed Matter. And just a little bit of context, ArtSpeak is undertaking a two-year initiative to turn this space into a space devoted to publications and artist books, and doing a lot of our programming off-site. So it's a way of giving a lot of attention to books, and also being able to work outside of the confines of the gallery. So I asked AA to do this project in part to contextualize the history, the strong history of artist books through that organization, and to help kind of bring attention to it in Vancouver. So without further ado, AA Bronson is, I'm sure, familiar to most of you here. He's a New York-based artist, curator, healer, and writer. And currently the director of Printed Matter in New York, as well as the director of the New York Art Book Fair, which takes place in October. In 1969, he founded General Idea with Felix Parts, Jorge Zontal, and they lived together and worked together for 25 years. So since 1994, and I should say they also started File magazine as well as Art Metropole, which AA will talk about, I think, a little bit in terms of its relationship to Printed Matter. So since 1994, AA has had a solo practice, including solo exhibitions at the Vienna Secession, the Power Plant, the Belkin here in Vancouver, the Whitney and Toronto Biennials, as well as the MCA Chicago. So welcome, AA.
Lots of familiar faces. Melanie forgot to mention that I was born in Vancouver General Hospital and spent the first 2 years of my life at 41st and Granville before leaving the city. But I've always had some sort of deep connection to this place, and I seem to end up back here repeatedly, whether I like it or not. And I feel I'm a little bit talking to the converted, since I think that Vancouver has always been such a strong place for publications and especially for artist books. And if we look back, for example, to the history of publishing in the 60s in Vancouver, all these small alternative presses and magazines, especially in the poetry scene and the overlap between the poetry scene and the art scene, it's a really incredible and amazing exhibition. And I was saying to Melanie a couple of days ago, it's incredible that nobody has done an exhibition of that material. At least I'm not aware of it. Can you hear me, by the way, back there? Is it okay? Speak up when you can't. And then in particular in the mid-60s, starting about, I think it's 67, there was the organization Intermedia, which probably most of you are familiar with here in Vancouver. And Intermedia was one of those early organizations that discovered the mimeograph machine. And from that mimeograph machine in their back room, they published amazing little layered publications that are very, very hard to find today, but really worth the search. And I always go back to Intermedia as my sort of touchstone for thinking about artist publications. I mean, obviously the Russian constructivists and the Dadaists and the Surrealists and so on and so forth were all involved with artist publications starting from the early 1900s. But it's only from about 1960 on that the particular flavor of artist self-publishing as we know it today comes to the surface. And it comes to the surface together with the idea of artist-initiated and artist-determined culture in general. For example, the whole artist-run center network of Canada. And that's now a pretty unique system here in Canada. There's not really anything like it anywhere anymore. Everywhere else, it's pretty much died off. As the universities have churned out arts administrators, they've all taken over what used to be artist-run organizations. With, I have to say, the exception of Printed Matter in New York, which is still very proudly artist-run. The history of artist publishing is quite interesting in how it relates to ideas about resistance. the real centers of artists self-publishing really were outside of the mainstream. They were not in New York or Paris, in London, but rather in South America, in Eastern Europe, in Japan. The South Americans in the 60s and 70s, well, the very fact of publishing anything on your own and not through some sort of approved system was automatically a radical idea and a politically dangerous idea. And so artist books from South America, from the late 60s especially, are really wrapped up with a kind of political resistance. And similarly in Eastern Europe, in the late 60s, there were many artists publishing little publications, but they were artists who were considered politically dangerous by their own governments, and often got them into deep trouble to publish those publications, even if they might on the surface appear quite playful and harmless. And then the other thing I always find interesting is how Yoko Ono's appearance in London and her relationship to John Lennon sort of opened a kind of funnel to the avant-garde of Japan that really comes out of the 50s. And the whole realm of Fluxus publishing, which was also another big area of publishing in the late 60s and early 70s, really comes from some sort of strange cross connection between what floats that way from Japan, what floats to Europe from Japan, and what comes out of Eastern Europe, and the two of them sort of mixed to form the Fluxus publishing. So those are where I see the roots. Now the first organization that was founded around the idea of artist books was called Other Books and So, and it was in Amsterdam. It was a little bookstore run by Ulysses Carrion. And half the bookstore was given to political literature, mostly anarchist and Marxist literature, and the other half was given to artist books. And he was from where? Colombia, I think? Not exactly sure. At any rate, Other Books and So was a place where many South American artists traveled through, and a lot of the artists fled South America because of the dictatorial regimes of that time and ended up in Amsterdam. Other Books and So then also brought in artist books from, you know, North America and Britain, I mean, Gilbert and George, people like that, and was the first kind of model for an institution looking at artist books. They also did little exhibitions on the walls that might have looked very much like this, in fact, except that there would be tables in the middle with books on them. The second organization that appeared was called Ecart, and it was run by John Armleiter out of Geneva. And that's quite a different sort of thing, and it reminds me a little more of Intermedia. It was a group of five or six artists who opened a little so-called shop where nothing ever had a price on it, and nobody knew where the key to the cash box was, and everybody was serving tea all the time. It was almost impossible to buy a book there. The only way I ever found to buy a book at Ecart was to steal it and then tell them afterwards, so they'd be forced to tell me how much it cost. Which never actually was very popular. So Ecart also had a mimeograph machine, the same as Intermedia, and they published lots of ephemera and little pamphlets by artists. And again, that little body of work became a kind of model for artists publishing in that area. The third organization was called Zona, and it was founded in Florence by an artist named Maurizio Nannucci with some friends. And it really began out of he really began as a book designer more than an artist. And he started collecting books. And of course, being in Florence, all the original futurist books could be found in Florence. And in fact, up until about 75 or 76, you could still find all the original futurist books for $6 or $7 each in the local bookstores. And he began compiling these collections, and that got him into the idea of what was happening with Other Books and So, and what was happening with Ecart, and a kind of little network set up within Europe. And he started collecting all this stuff in Zona, and then doing exhibitions. It wasn't so much about sales at Zona, it was about some publishing mixed with a lot of exhibitions around the idea of artists' books and ephemera. So in a way, the program that ArtSpeak is planning here for the next 2 years is actually quite similar to what Zona was doing in the 70s in Florence. Exhibitions, sort of artists who worked with and around books, and then other kinds of projects in outside locations or on the street. The fourth organization that opened devoted to artist books was Art Metropole in Toronto, which we have general idea opened in 1972. We started File magazine, and File initially was a kind of offshoot of Vancouver culture, I would say, because it came to a certain extent out of Image Bank and the Western, well, the Western Front didn't exist then, but the predecessors to the Western Front. And the idea of a sharing of images, and our other big connection was to Ray Johnson in New York and his correspondence, his so-called correspondence school. So File came out of that, and as soon as we started publishing File, people started sending us their publications and their books, I guess hoping that we would publish reviews. But as we began to collect these things, we realized we were developing an archive of very significant material, which was for the most part being overlooked. And so we began Art Metropole in 72 as a way of accessing our distribution system, the File magazine distribution system, to other artists, and also putting together, and also being able to protect and properly look after the archive of artist publications that we were assembling. So before I leave Art Metropole, I'll just say that by the late 90s, that collection had become so enormous and so valuable that we could no longer afford to insure it. Artist books of the early 70s are in some cases now worth fabulous sums of money. And so at that time, we passed the collection along to the National Gallery of Canada. And there is now a touring exhibition of the Art Metropole collection that's going around Canada. I'm not sure where it is right now. Maybe it's here in Vancouver.
Next summer. Mm-hmm. Next summer it'll be in Vancouver.
Next summer. Okay. So that was Art Metropole. That was 74 we started Art Metropole. In 76, a group of American artists, notably Saul LeWitt and then the critic Lucy Lepard, decided that they would like to found some sort of organization based on artist books. And originally the idea was completely modeled on Art Metropole. There was going to be a kind of archive, and there was going to be a distribution system, and there'd be a little publishing program, and the whole thing would work together. They were probably more demanding and difficult temperaments than the Canadian temperament tends to be. So almost instantly they got into big fights with each other, and they split into two organizations, one of which became Franklin Furnace, which became the archive of artist books, and actually these days is more devoted to performance art, and the other became Printed Matter, which originally was just going to be a publishing program. The books on the rail on this side of the room are, with the exception of the last one, all books that were published by Printed Matter at the very beginning, so in 76, 77. And they had very idealistic idea. They thought they were going to sell them in supermarkets at the takeouts. And they thought they were going to sell, you know, hundreds of thousands of these books. And why they thought this, I have no idea. They soon discovered that nobody wanted their books. I think it took about 2 months before they discovered that even to sell two or three copies was going to be tough. So they realized that what they really needed to work on was the distribution system. And then they set up a little storefront on Lispinard Street in Tribeca, which is now, I think, a veterinary clinic. So from the beginning, it was a very democratic, very American ideal in a way. The idea was that any artist could bring their books into Printed Matter, and Printed Matter would distribute them. And on consignment, every 6 months, every artist would get a statement about how many books have been sold, and a check for the books that have been sold in the previous 6 months. It was around that time I made my first visit to Printed Matter. I think it was 76, actually, because I was living in New York in 1976. It was when they first opened, and it was a little white interior. Everything was white, and the shelves were lined up the walls, sort of on angles, a little bit like this, all painted white, and then all the books were white. This was coincidental, but it seemed that the American artists, in particular the conceptual artists who were most interested in making books, were all making very white books. So there was only one book, I remember this very clearly, there was only one book in the entire store which did not have a white cover, and it had a black cover. Do you need to close the door? There seem to be more trucks appearing. I don't know.
I can't even hear you what you're saying now.
Oh, okay. I said maybe you need to close the door so people can hear. Printed matter always sort of saw itself as a site of resistance. It was based on very Marxist principles, the idea that every artist was equal to every other artist. There would be no judgments made. Everybody's book would be equal. And of course, this was clearly impossible. We now represent 5,000 artists and 15,000 titles. And if we had to write 5,000 checks every 6 months and calculate how many copies of each of those 15,000 titles we'd sold, we'd need a massive staff to do it, or else a much more sophisticated computer system than we have. So by the mid-80s, printed matter had to try to temper its policies around what books it sold, and it began to make judgments. It tried to do that. I mean, printed matter comes from the New York avant-garde is really rooted in a way in the labor union movement, I always think, which is in a way ironic because the labor union movement really started in Winnipeg and Saskatchewan and moved down into the US from there. So I always think that the labor union movement is a Canadian thing to begin with. But at any rate, in New York, it has a very particular flavor and a very particular form. And I think printed matter is strong evidence of that. Printed matter has always been very, although we're not allowed to be political as a nonprofit, it's always been quite political in its choice of material itself. So although we have to be careful to say that the things we sell do not necessarily represent our viewpoint, we sell a lot of politically motivated work, especially this year. What else can I say about the history of printed matter? In the late 80s, it moved to a very large storefront in Soho, the beautiful space, which they paid $3,000 a month for. I think it was 3,500 square feet on the ground floor. And when they eventually had to move out, they were evicted by Dia, who owned the building. The next tenant who moved in paid $44,000 a month. At that point, printed matter was sort of in deep trouble because real estate prices, and many arts organizations in New York got to this point, the real estate prices had become so expensive in New York, and the sort of alternative spaces really couldn't afford them. I was on the board at this time, we ended up in a little lobby space in a gallery building in Chelsea, which was great in that there were 300 galleries within three blocks. So there were lots of art people. But what it took away from printed matter was that sort of feeling of open access that it always had, that it was a storefront, that anybody could come and sell their books there, and that anybody might walk in by accident and buy books. I started as director 4 years ago, so the first thing I did was to move it to a storefront on 10th Avenue and 22nd Street. And the avenues, all the galleries for the most part are on the cross streets, and the avenues are much more public places where there tend to be restaurants and so on. So it's a bit, and actually Mark, who's back here with the beer, designed the new storefront. And it's been a phenomenal success. It's very interesting because people always think that the book audience is an older audience and that the book audience is dying and that it's only people, you know, of my generation that really continue to buy books in any sort of developed way. But what we found at Printed Matter is that about 65% of our audience is under 35, and a massive quantity of the audience is in their early 20s. So there's a very different sort of phenomenon happening now. We sell about $15,000 worth of books a week, so the place is crammed with people. It's very, very active, and it's like there's a kind of book renaissance. Of course, part of it also has to do with the kind of shift in the design world. The whole phenomenon of the artist's book had an effect on the design world, and now many museum catalogs or just more mainstream books are designed to look as if they're an artist's book. You know, they have a much more creative, more playful approach to the book design. And so the artist's book, instead of being something esoteric, is now something very easy for young people to engage in. The exhibition here is arranged so that the books on this, everything here was published by Printed Matter. And it's a selection of the books we've published over the years, and then also fundraising multiples and a few posters and so on and so forth. On the shelf, on that side of the room is all books from the 70s. We stopped publishing pretty much by the end of the 70s and then started again about 2002. So all the books on this side of the room are from 2002 to the present. I guess you can see the youthful audience of Printed Matter reflected in some of the objects that the artists have made. For example, Liam Gillick's skateboard in the center of the wall there. And there's two other skateboards, one by Ari Marikopoulos, which is a little invisible around the corner, facing out the window. And then on the left here is a skateboard by Mark Gonzalez. Now, Mark Gonzalez is an interesting figure because although he must be about 40 now, he was one of the originators of the whole skateboard scene. And he really invented most of the major moves that skateboarders use today. He's also a poet, and he's published many zines himself, and he's also an artist. He's a total cult figure to a sort of skateboarder generation and community. And he's obviously a very innovative guy. But when I look at his zines, what I see is something very similar to the intermedia publishing of the late 60s. What have I forgotten to talk about? Oh, we're just starting a new program, which I think it's a program that comes out of my particular Canadian perspective. You know, there's very little money available for artists in the U.S. except in the marketplace. The marketplace drives everything, and in fact, there's a lot of money available through the marketplace. But of course, the marketplace has its own demands on artists. The NEA does not give grants to artists, and many of the granting bodies within the U.S. have stopped giving money to artists. So Printed Matter is now starting a grant-giving program. We're going to, beginning in 2009, I think we'll start by giving out about, there'll be small grants. We'll give out 20 to 25 grants, varying from $1,500 to $5,000, and entirely to artists who are working with the book form. But it's I think, interesting because it's an innovative thing. I don't know of any other organization that's doing that, that isn't a foundation or something like that. And so it sets a new kind of model for American organizations. And it also puts the artist first, which, of course, is the whole idea of Printed Matter, is that ultimately we're trying to get money back into the artist's pockets and to support the artist. We're part of the infrastructure of the artist's survival in general, but in very particularly in New York City, where it can be so difficult to survive. Many artists have had their first shows at Printed Matter. We really push an emphasis on the emerging artists. So, for example, Richard Prince had his first show at Printed Matter, and Jenny Holzer had her second show at Printed Matter. And the artists know that, so they're very loyal back to us. There's two shopping bags there designed by Barbara Kruger as fundraisers for Printed Matter. Richard Prince did a photo edition for us, which raised $120,000 for us. The artists have been very, very generous with Printed Matter. 2 years ago, we began something called the New York Art Book Fair, because we were aware of the fact that with, you know, Amazon and things like that, bookstores were closing right and left. And New York, which had been such a center for art books, had pretty much most of the stores were gone. The museum shops were downgraded to sort of bestsellers. So we began the New York Art Book Fair as a way to bring back the world of art publishing into New York. We began it first of all as just a little test project. We hired somebody for 1 month to sort of poke around and see if she could raise any interest. And within that 4 weeks, the DIA Foundation had offered to donate 16,000 square feet of space to hold the fair in, and we had at that point about 30-35 publishers from around the world who already wanted to come. So the first fair, in fact, had 70 exhibitors, including, I think there was one table of about six exhibitors, I think, from Vancouver. Led by Kathy, I think. By the second year, we had 123 exhibitors. This year, we've moved the fair, because in the meantime, DIA got rid of that building, so we've moved the fair to the Phillips Tapuri Auction House, which is in the same general neighborhood. And we've been inundated with demands for exhibition space. We're having to turn people away, which is extremely uncomfortable, because our idea is to be inclusive, not exclusive. So the way we've done it is we're paring down from the top. You know, we threw Tashin out of the fair, because Tashin, the amount of space that Tashin wanted, we could fit 12 little publishers in. So Tashin bit the dust. So that fair is on the desk here. There's a little postcard for it, and that happens on the 23rd to the 26th of October.
The books themselves, you mean?
Well, we, you know, our publishing program is pretty small. We only do 4 books a year. Although I have to admit, we've just started a new program, which is based on the history of pamphleteering. Pamphleteering is a political process from the 19th century. So we're bringing out a series of artist pamphlets called Artists and Activists. And for each pamphlet, we've invited an artist or an artist group to design a pamphlet. Now, that's a very conventional form of production. It's offset mass market production. And on the whole, that's mostly what we use. However, the range of kinds of production at printed matter itself is very, very broad. I mean, there are artists who are making things by hand using silkscreen and lithography, although I'd say they're in the minority at this point. There are a lot of artists using photocopying, basically. And in fact, that last publication on the shelf over there is a text about photocopying as being a kind of liberating mode of production. I think if you look back at the history of artist books, it's also tied into a history of technologies. So in the mid-60s, the web offset press is invented, and that's the point where underground papers appeared, because it became possible to produce a newspaper cheaply in a smallish quantity. And at the same time, there's the mimeograph machine and the Ronio machine, all those related machines, which were really aimed at schools and places like that that needed to print, 100 copies of an exam paper or something. And the number of periodicals and small books that appeared that were printed on the mimeograph machine in the late 60s is phenomenal. And then in the 70s, you have the invention of the paper plate, quick copy, I think you called it. And so suddenly there was a kind of offset printing, but a very low quality offset printing that allowed, again, for a lot of what was called special interest group publishing. And then at a certain point, the price of offset printing itself just comes down so far that people start to be able to use it, and you get neighborhood offset printers and so on and so forth. So we have, printed matter examples of all those kinds of things. We only accept books that are in editions of at least 100. We don't accept anything smaller than that, although occasionally I have to admit we play favorites if the book seems to be within the philosophy of printed matter, even if it's in a smaller edition. I would say maybe 3/4 of the books are just normal offset printing, nothing special. The Fierce Pussy book here is a book of tear-out posters that you can wheat paste yourself on the street. There's many formats that one can use. I think China entering the world of printing also made a lot of things possible. It suddenly became feasible to print photography books, which photography books were always incredibly difficult to publish unless you could get the Coach House Press or a small press interested in publishing your book. Otherwise, it was hopeless. But now with China, the costs of printing photography books have come way down. So there's a lot more artists working with photography than there used to be. We did a Fierce Pussy exhibition. Fierce Pussy was a lesbian collective from the early 90s that mostly postered. And they were most famous, actually, more recently, they did an action in Grand Central Station during the, was it the Republican Convention? The Republican Convention in New York a few years back, where they met, because they're all women, of course, and some of them very attractive women, they were actually able to sneak into Grand Central Station and sort of flirt with the security guards and get them all off guard, and then drop a huge banner off the mezzanine level, which appeared on television, and it was at rush hour. All these people got to see it, so they're very much a kind of activist. They've also done a lot of actions around AIDS and HIV and so on. So we decided that with the exhibition in LA, which is coming here next month, the WAC exhibition, which is coming here next month. It was coming to PS1, and that exhibition stops at, I think, 1978, and the stuff post-1978 was pretty much getting ignored. And we wanted to do some sort of exhibition that specifically looked at the sort of more politically based work from that period. So we did an exhibition with Fierce Pussy. There was a lot of documentation and stuff they'd done, but they produced, there's a poster hanging just inside of the window on the left there. They produced a poster, and what we did was we did a kind of action on our own building. So we plastered the front of the store as if somebody had done it in the middle of the night with this sort of pro-lesbian culture poster. And we did this at about, I don't know, it was like 1:00 PM or something. The girls were out there with their wheat pasting. And by 2:00, the police had arrived. I have to say they were fairly cool about it. They said to me, we're not saying it's illegal what you're doing, but we do have to tell you that the community is complaining around you, and they feel it's obscene and blah, blah, blah. And then they never came back. That was it. So that actually was pretty good. I did one day, I was standing outside getting a breath of air on the street, and there's a telephone booth right outside Printed Matter, and I heard a woman on the phone reading the poster to somebody on the phone. It was interesting that she didn't have a cell phone. She was in the phone booth. And then she said, "I'm going to close this place down if it's the last thing I do." But we never heard another word from her. And we never once received a complaint to our faces, only through the police or through word of mouth or things like that. Anyway, that's one of the